think he likes you.
That's cool. I don't like him either.
Man, such a thing simply couldn't happen twice, Charlie.
I think I better warn you. I have a 7 o'clock class tomorrow.
People actually go to school at 7 in the morning? That's idiotic. It's insane. It's un-American.
You're supposed to bite on the neck, asshole. I'm not thirsty right now, man.
This guy had a mouth like yours, good lips. And he knew how to use them. Do you know how to use your lips, Charlie?
We need holy water.
Holy water.
We need communion wafers.
Communion wafers? You mean this stuff kills vampires? Am I gonna go to hell for this? You scared me to death.
Sorry. You look great scared.
Let's talk about blood, Mr. Vincent. It's very precious to me.
Welcome to Fright Night. Part 2. On this week's episode of Horror Weekly, we're going to be talking about the strange tale of Fright Night Part 2, a truly great and underappreciated horror sequel from 1988, directed by Tommy Lee Wallace of Halloween 3 and Stephen King's 1990 It miniseries fame. We're going to spend a good chunk of this episode very lovingly walking through the movie, so if you haven't seen it and you care about spoilers, please go watch it, come back, and rejoin us on this journey. And if you don't care about spoilers, let's go. We're also going to be covering some very bizarre and kind of horrifying reasons why this movie isn't better known, and I'm going to be exploring two premises that I think are like under talked about for this movie. It has one of the great hero protagonists in horror movie history, and her name is Alex. And it also has Charlie Brewster, who is not cool. He sucks and kind of always has. I know you Fright Night fans out there right now are screaming like a vampire being doused by holy water. And don't get me wrong, I love the Fright Night franchise, and I love Charlie Brewster. I love that he sucks. I think it's so interesting and rare. I remember when the Lord of the Rings movies came out, how much the character of Frodo Baggins bothered me in those movies. It was like he never did anything. The crowning thing that almost made me walk out of the theater was after, you know, 1,000 hours of film or however long it took to get to the last movie and the last scenes of the last movie, when they're climbing Mount Doom, after everyone else has done almost all the fighting and all the trekking and all the scheming, basically Frodo looks up at Sam and is like, staring up at the mountain, he's like, I can't make it. And poor Sam, who, like, he gives him his last, you know, food or whatever, and slings him over his shoulder, picks him up, like, I'm gonna carry you up the hill. Like, Frodo does nothing. And I see Charlie's character in Fright Night that way a lot. It's a little hard to see because you're having so much fun watching it. But I think you'll see as we walk through this movie that he does a lot less than you remember. And I do want to get one other thing out of the way before we dive into this gem. So there are certain iconic characters in horror. We all know their names. The Laurie Strodes and the Ash Williams and the Quints, etc. And one thing I've always been kind of obsessed with the truly great characters, is what is their final image on screen? What's the last shot we get of these characters? And some of them are epic, but some of them are very unfortunate. It's actually a lot more common than I thought as a really young horror fan. It's not easy to nail that last shot. Sometimes you don't even know it's going to be the last shot. Maybe most of the time you don't know that. But if you compose your shots well and you're always trying to get like maximum intensity and beauty out of what you're filming, the odds are you're going to leave a great one. But that doesn't happen a lot, even for our greatest horror characters. For example, the final image of Freddy Krueger on film is a winking, decapitated Freddy head being carried by Jason like a bowling ball. Man, is that insufficient. Like, I thought Freddy vs. Jason was fun enough, right? But out of all the greatness that Freddy has given us over the years, for that to be his last image, and I'm not counting the remake, obviously, for that to be the last image of the Robert Englund Freddy on screen, I think is kind of weak. The final image we have of Ellen Ripley is sitting somewhere having a boring conversation with Winona Ryder and staring at like a bad effect of a smoldering or Eiffel Tower looking like a poster of As Above, So Below, and also looking like we're in kind of a lame fanfic of Planet of the Apes somehow. She just deserved so much better. And speaking of deserving better, the last time we see Sidney Prescott on film is a kind of blurry shot of her over a Melissa Barrera's shoulder sitting on the bumper of an ambulance while totally out of focus while Melissa's having this hilarious Billy Loomis hallucination. I really hope Neve Campbell comes back because I don't want that to be the last image of one of the greatest final girls. But I consider Roddy McDowell's Peter Vincent as one of the truly great characters in horror movies. Absolutely iconic, absolutely unforgettable, charming and vulnerable and surprisingly brave at times and surprisingly knowledgeable, but surprisingly not. There's a lot in horror that's divisive to the horror community. I feel like these days I can't even post something on the Horror Weekly page about something as common as like The Exorcist and not have a sliver now of people being like overrated, boring, etc. But I just can't imagine being a horror fan and not loving Peter Vincent. So the fact that he goes out on an image so beautiful and so perfect in this movie, which is the last time we see at least this incarnation of the character, just fills my heart with joy. And I know this is weird. I know we're starting at the end. I'll get to it in more detail as we walk through the movie. But he's basically staring down from above at the top of an elevator shaft with a beam of light on him as he's just vanquished yet another head vampire, another final boss. And his friends that he's saved are at the bottom of the shaft, and he's beaming down at them, so proud of himself, but so tired too. Poor Peter. I mean, he's like asked to be an action star a lot of the times in these movies at his age, and it's just, I mean, it's gotta hurt. But then he kind of just smiles to himself and turns away and kind of contemplates and soaks in the moment of victory. And that's it. That's our last sight of this amazing character. And there's no way to do it better. So I know there's a lot of people who even like this movie a lot who defend it, but mainly defend it as like great 80s cheese. And I'm telling you, there are movies done with a lot more quote-unquote big-name talent, with a lot more gravitas and trying to be a lot more serious A24 style, who absolutely do not pull off an image this gorgeous of an important character on their way out. So I love this movie. Join me as we gather up the steaks and the garlic and the crosses and the communion wafers and a little bit of faith, and explore Fright Night Part 2.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great hook or innovation that happens at the opening of Fright Night Part 2. We join Charlie after some long period of therapy he's been undergoing since the ending of Fright Night Part 1, and he is now convinced that there were no vampires, that it was a delusion that his mind created to protect him from the awful reality that he was face to face with a serial killer in Chris Sarandon's character instead of a fearsome vampire. And I don't remember seeing this a lot in horror, particularly franchise horror. I mean, we're starting a movie with someone who went through a whole bunch of beloved events by horror fans and now believes none of them actually were what they were. It would be like Jamie Lee Curtis not believing Michael Myers existed at the beginning of Halloween 2, or Nancy Thompson not believing Freddy can invade dreams, or like Jonathan Harker from Dracula getting back from Transylvania and being like, yeah, that was all fine, I'm just going to go back into real estate. Maybe I'll head over to Germany. I hear there's a nice doctor named Frankenstein who's looking for some land. And then we get the Fright Night Part 2 title card. There's been a lot of talk recently about how glorious the title card to Evil Dead Rise was, the opening one. And that's true. It was spectacular. And don't get me wrong, by comparison, the Fright Night 2 title card looks like it was created on Microsoft Paint, but it's still glorious in its own way, because you have Charlie saying to his therapist, vampires are not real, and then smash cut to Fright Night with the fangs coming out of the font. And it's part of what gives this movie its energy. It's a movie that's in dialogue with itself. There are a bunch of people who don't believe things that go bump in the night, and creatures and vampires and zombies and werewolves, they don't believe they exist. And this, the movie believes it's a lot more fun to at least believe in the possibility that they do. But Charlie rushes back to his college dorm now that he's been released, I guess, from his delusions, and immediately finds all his old vampire killing tools in his kit and throws him in the dumpster out back, which is awesome. I imagine some like college student strolling by to throw away something and just seeing a whole bunch of garlic and steaks and crucifixes laying in a dumpster and wondering what the hell's going on around here. And then we cut to Peter Vincent's hosting what will be his last Fright Night TV appearance, even though he doesn't know it at the time. He's totally demolishing his own career. He's self-destructing because he's not following the script. He keeps telling the TV audience about how he himself has confronted vampires. And he's coming off to the people who run the show, and who knows, maybe a lot of his audience at this point, as someone who has believed too much of his own hype. So you can tell there are plans in motion to cancel the show or replace Peter as a host, which everyone is aware of except for him, apparently, which is sad because, I mean, as soon as that Fright Night show came up when I was watching it, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to care if the rest of this movie is bad, if it gives me a bunch of Roddy McDowell. And then we cut to Charlie and meet Alex, his girlfriend, as they go over to see Peter Vincent for the first time since the events of Fright Night Part 1. And Charlie is very nervous because he no longer believes what happened was real, but he knows that Peter Vincent does. Alex is studying, I think, clinical psychology or something in school. You can tell she's kind of a hard skeptic and very, very smart. And we're going to, I mean, Alex is the true hero of this movie, I'm convinced. So we'll get signs of that really quick, because we go to where Peter Vincent lives, which is apparently Hotel Dracula, an amazing, atmospheric, pure American Hammer Films shot of a building and a moon, and oh, just perfect. And then we go into Peter's place, which is covered in memorabilia. It's like if Quentin Tarantino had only made horror movies, what he did in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with Leo's Place, with the posters and the props, so, but it's the horror version. So Peter Vincent's got everything saved. And while Peter and Charlie are huddled off to one side and Alex is exploring the apartment, Peter like sort of side whispers to him, have you told Alex? Does she know? And she's like, I can hear you from across the room. And she's like, he has told me all about it. And Alex is going to answer for herself. Every time there's some kind of combination of characters in this movie that tries to wall her out, like, don't worry, we got this. The heroes got this or whatever. She's like, no, 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 that's not how this is going to work. No one speaks for me. No one acts for me. It's kind of amazing. Honestly, both Julie Carmen as Regine, the head vampire, and Alex, and Peter Vincent, out of the four, that core four, including Charlie, he's the weakest. Let's be honest. Out of the four by far. And it's kind of amazing. His charm is that he loves the things we do as horror fans, clearly. But also his other charm, and I didn't notice this. I'm going to have to go back and watch Fright Night 1. I've seen it a few times at this point, but I didn't rewatch it before recording this podcast, although I suspect a lot of this is going to bear to that too. But a lot of his charm in this movie is the movie forces him to play act like a young adult. His clothes are ridiculous. He's always wearing outfits that, like, I mean, he's basically wearing what the psychiatrist was wearing a lot of the time. He looks like he's dressing to be 20 years older than he is. After this ridiculous outfit, later on, we're going to see him dressed up to go to the opera, and he looks like he's in, like, a James Bond movie, but the kid style. Poor Charlie is being forced to grow up way too fast. So one thing I love about this sequel is that it doesn't wait to get to the horror. After this little brief intro where we've got a bunch of horror implements and things in the background, we immediately get to some very atmospheric things. Charlie and Alex are in a car. Charlie acts like a total asshole in the car towards Alex, which is he's going to do this multiple times in this movie because, like I said, he sucks. And while they're in the car, semi-making out, Regine flies Lost Boys style through the air, descends on the car, and is basically laying on the roof of it, unbeknownst to Charlie and Alex below. And it's a gorgeous shot. Alex gets mad at Charlie for being Charlie, and then she walks home. And it reminded me of Blood and Black Lace, a very atmospheric, foggy kind of walk back to her dorm or whatever. And she's being stalked, POV stalked, like Michael Myers POV stalked a lot of the time. And she just misses being attacked. I was going to say being a victim, but I'm pretty sure she would have handled it given what we're going to see out of her in the future. But she just misses getting attacked. And the roller skating vampire, Belle, yes, you heard me. She diverts and goes to get another victim. And this should have been, like everyone who kind of was praising this movie online, this should have just been like glorious cheese. But as ridiculous as the premise of a roller skating vampire is, when Belle actually comes down the hall and goes in for the kill, it's like an iconic vampire shot. The camera's really close on her face as she's closing in on her prey. And if you just like froze it there when she's like full in the frame, you're not seeing roller skates. You're just seeing a pretty scary vampire. And this one shot would have made a better poster than like 50% of the horror movie posters I saw for supposedly better movies from like last year. And then when she attacks the victim, there's a very stylish like blood spatter on pages. It's a great kill. So now another member of the vampire gang. So there's basically the head vampire, Regine. There's Belle, the roller skating vampire. There's Louis, the vampire / werewolf. And there's Bosworth, the like straker from Salem's Lot of the situation. Speaking of Salem's Lot, so Louie tries a window attack on Alex, and she effortlessly defeats him by closing the window without knowing she's doing it on his hands, breaking his werewolfy fingernails, and sending him plummeting to the ground. By the way, Louie is played by the amazing John Grease of... So, if you follow the podcast at all, you know I'm not a big comedy person. It's a weakness in my film knowledge. So, when I posted about this movie and there was a picture of him, everyone was like, Uncle Rico, and I had no idea what that meant. But I guess he was in Napoleon Dynamite. But I know him primarily from Monster Squad and Real Genius. But Fright Night Part 2 is my favorite performance of his by far. So now that the vampire gang's subordinates have failed to inflict any damage on Alex, Regine moves in for her first run at Charlie. She shows up at the dorm with a brilliant subterfuge, pretending she's looking for someone else named Charlie, but Charlie Cassidy, not Charlie Brewster. So it's not suspicious that she's just like knocking on his dorm. She walks away casually. He's like sort of scared, but sort of regretting she's walking away because he's already like super attracted to her. Great way to be faithful to Alex, Charlie. And then Regine turns around, asks if he has a light, comes to his door, the threshold of his room, but does not enter. You would think, of all people, Charlie Brewster would know what this means, but without even a pause, he's like, come in, because why not invite vampires in? When she's heading down the hall to come in, he's like frantically running around his little crappy room, trying to hide, you know, it's like the move Matthew Broderick makes in War Games before Ally Sheedy shows up, just like hiding everything disgusting and like whatever. And he takes his whole pile of books that he's studying and throws them in his bathtub and draws the curtain to hide it. But the image of him throwing away all that, all the knowledge as the vampire's heading to come into the room, for some reason struck me as weirdly meaningful. Who needs stupid knowledge when a hot vampire is on the way? And I mean, just props to Tommy Lee Wallace for the posters in Charlie's room. They're all hilarious. It's a very like Altman's movie, The Player, how there were movie posters in the background that kind of indicated to you what was happening in the plot if you caught them. And the posters in Charlie's dorm are incredibly hilarious. The moment where Regine is biting his neck and basically drawing first blood and making Charlie begin to submit to her vampire spell, you see over his shoulder a poster for a movie called Women's Prison, which is hilarious because she's literally about to enslave him. There's another poster behind him in another shot that just says push over, which is a lot of how I see Charlie. There's I was a teenage caveman, which is a really young person gradually turning into a monster. Just a lot of really good stuff from this movie. And there's a little bit of business after that I'm going to skip, even though it's all pretty great. But eventually, Charlie and Peter come to suspect that Regine is another head vampire to be dealt with. And they go to track her down. She lives in the same building now as Peter Vincent. And they go to her apartment to track her down. And it's from this moment through the rest of the film that I think is one of the greatest stretches of cinema in 80s horror sequeldom. The movie really comes to life, or undeadness, from here on. One element of the original Fright Night that this movie takes up and amplifies in a really clever way is the strategy of these vampires of kind of hiding in plain sight. They're not lurking around in sepulchers like Dracula used to do. Well, that's not true. Dracula moved about in polite society too, especially in the novel. But whatever, it takes that vampire tradition and gives it a really cool modern spin because everyone's hiding in plain sight here. Regine is pretending to be a vampire performance artist, she's a performance artist who acts out a vampire ethos. So every time she does something that's like super vampire like, it looks incredible and chilling. And then all of a sudden people are applauding and asking for her autograph, which is what happens at this party. Another little trick, I never drink wine, as Dracula says, is that the vampires in Fright Night Part 2 are always asking for beverages, even though we never see them drinking them. When Regine confronts or comes to see Charlie in his dorm and the first time, she's like, I would kill for a cup of coffee. When Charlie's roommate ends up being found at this party that Charlie and Peter are investigating, he's like, Charlie's like, I'm here to help you. And he's like, well, I could use a Perrier, which he takes and grabs, but then stalks off. Again, we're not seeing him drink it. We're just seeing them ask for it. And then the very slick and cool performance art pieces that Regine are doing weirdly anticipates like the whole vampire Lestat vibes from Anne Rice. Now, remember, we were talking at the beginning about how Fright Night Part 2 strangely does a better job of giving us the final image of a great horror character than a lot of movies that are supposedly better than it is. And here's another thing that's very hard to do. How do you try to even approach the you have to have faith scene from Fright Night 1? It's one of the greatest quotes in horror movie history. It's one of the greatest moments. Even trying to do a variation on it seems like insanely brave. And I think if it was being done in a modern horror movie, the odds are that it would just come off as incredibly fan servicey. But it does not at all here. It's so good and so authentic because after Charlie leaves the vampire party, convinced that he was wrong and the, you know, that the it's not a vampire's after all, and his psychiatrist was right, so Charlie defaults to his position that he had at the beginning of this movie, Peter realizes that they've been tricked, that these are actual vampires because they're not showing reflections. And then he gets into a stairwell confrontation with Regine. Now, all the scenes in this movie between Regine and Peter Vincent are gold. But in this confrontation, Peter pulls out a cross, and it's just like when Chris Sarandon was confronted with it. And in this version, Julie Carmen is just smiling at him, and the cross is doing nothing. And no, neither of them are moving. And then she tells him, you're going to have to get a lot closer than that. After so many centuries of exposure, you start to build up a little tolerance for the trappings. And her sinister confidence and that notion that, oh, yeah, you can try a cross on me, but you're going to have to get really, really close to me for it to start to work. Why don't you take some steps forward? And Peter is just paralyzed. And then the dismissiveness of calling like the symbol of the religion that's supposed to defeat you as just the trappings. I mean, this just comes off as the way that actual vampires would talk if they were real. It's so good. So then Peter tries to alert Charlie to the fact that they were wrong, that these are real vampires and it's all happening again. Charlie blows him off. Peter goes through a dark night of the soul, hides out in his place with locked doors and surrounding himself with circles of garlic and crosses. And then poor Peter ends up, once it becomes daylight, at a bar. And this is just the greatest little bit of acting. God bless Roddy McDowall. He's in the bar. He orders a beer. This would just be a throwaway moment for 90% of actors in horror movie sequels. But when the bartender brings him a beer, he looks down at it and you see it on his face. He doesn't want it. He doesn't want to be some old, retired, has-been, fired from his TV show guy sitting in bars drinking beers. He stares at it like the guy just put something gross in front of him, even though it's what he just ordered. And then we hear that amazing Fright Night intro coming from the TV in the bar, and Peter looks up to see that his show has been given to the vampire. Like I said, Regine is the host, the new host of Fright Night, and it's the ultimate hiding in plain sight moment, right? Like, this is better than Kurt Sarandon just being the guy next door, the friendly neighbor. This is someone hosting the show that used to be hosted by the fearless vampire killer. And everyone just thinks, oh, no, new upgrade, younger host, like whatever. But it's the actual vampire. Now, this is a hard movie to go through chronologically at this point because it's jumping back and forth between scenes a lot. So we'll get to the amazing performance Regine gives as the Fright Night host in a second. But let's hang with Peter in the bar for one more moment, because while he's watching TV and his whole life is crashing down around his ears, a guy walks up and approaches him in from the back of the bar and goes, "You look familiar. I've seen your face, haven't you? Who are you?" And he just says under his breath, like really kind of small and broken. The guy asks, I've seen your face. What do you do? And Peter says in that small voice, "I kill vampires." And then the guy goes, "What?" And he goes, "What do you do, really?" And Peter again says, "I'm a vampire killer." But now the second time he's saying it, he's hearing it and realizing that's what I want to be. I don't want to be this retired beer drinking guy in a bar. And then the guy asks him again, which is just rude at this point. And Peter Vincent gets off the stool, stands up, draws up to his full, I don't know, 5'6" height, stares at this big confrontational guy and goes, "Are you hard of hearing? I kill vampires." And then he gets this amazing, confident smile on his face and just leaves the bar. And the fact that Roddy McDowall could take the same basic sentence, "I'm a vampire killer, I kill vampires, I'm a vampire killer," and say it three different ways in like 6 seconds, one completely broken, one sort of starting to realize that that's what I am at my core or what I want to be, and the last one being, it's not what I want to be, it's what I am, is just amazing. There's an incredible, one of my favorite lines in Shakespeare, it's from Love's Labour's Lost, is a line that says, "Light seeking light doth light of light beguile." It's using the word light like 4 times out of 10 words or something. But every time it uses the word light, it means something different. It's basically someone who's reading too much and losing their eyesight because they're reading too much. So it's light, your brain seeking light, which is knowledge, doth light, eyesight. Of light beguile, which is the eyes lose it. So it's literally the same word being used 4 different ways in like a blitz fashion. And that's what Peter does in this scene. It's like, "I'm a vampire killer. I'm a vampire killer." It's incredible. But as good as that small moment was, we're about to get to the one of the greatest things in this movie, which is Charlie has now re-realized, the movie keeps trading off who realizes, who believes at what point, that he's dealing with vampires, because now he's turning into one and he can't ignore it. He tries to eat pizza with garlic on it, and that has predictable results since he's basically half vampire by now. And he goes straight to the vampire's lair, which is points to Charlie, even though he's going to totally screw this up. One of the few times he tries to accomplish something on his own without backup. And he's going to go find Regine and find her coffin and stake her in the heart. And I am telling you, this scene, I watched it 3 times in a row because I couldn't even believe how good it was. Charlie makes his way through the lair, has some adventures, and then finally locates the Queen Vampire's coffin, which is an incredible coffin design, by the way, and throws the lid open. He's got like a stake in his hand, like a stake he improvised from a table leg or whatever. So it doesn't even look great, but it'll do the job. And you see Regine laying in the coffin. Now, one of the things about vampires in movies is my brain is always kicked, even as a kid, on how stupid it is to lay your coffin anywhere that could be accessible by humans, because you've lived like centuries and like all this time and defeated and killed so many things, and anyone can just stroll in and stake you the heart between the hours of like 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. It's a pretty bad weakness to have. And then we have this same moment. I mean, Charlie basically didn't even have to do anything. He just kind of like snuck his way around. And now here he is. He's going to dispatch the queen vampire and the whole thing is going to end. And her like 1,000 years of existence is going to be cut off at a stroke. And most vampire movies don't deal with this massive vampire weakness that well. But the answer that Fright Night Part 2 has is so good and so convincing, because after Charlie lifts the lid, he gathers up the courage to do it. He's watching Regine just lay there with her eyes closed. He raises the stake in the air to bring it down into her heart. And as soon as his hands go up, her eyes open. It's almost like there are strings on his fingers attached to her eyelids, and his motion brings her eyes open. The timing is chilling. I got goosebumps watching it. And she's just staring directly at him. She's laying in the coffin like if she opened her eyes, she'd be looking up. But she's staring right at him like she knew the whole time it was happening. Well, what is a vampire going to do in the middle of the daylight to defend themselves? She stares him in the eyes. Her eyes get glowing red. She's obviously hypnotizing him or casting a spell or something like that. And his eyes get a red glow in him. And then she closes her eyes. He is still standing there with the stake over her heart. And she, I mean, the confidence in your power that it must take with someone hovering with a sharpened stake point above your heart still, and to just close your eyes and go back to sleep is, it's marvelous. She's defended herself with evil mental power, and Charlie stumbles out of the room and stumbles into the street and almost gets run over by a truck. He's in a complete daze and then doesn't even remember any of that happened. He's reset somehow. It's just one of the most visually striking a vampire defends herself moments I've ever seen. And almost nothing moved. Like the lid of the coffin opened. Charlie raised the stake and she opened her eyes. Like she didn't get up. He didn't take any action. It was like the greatest action moment with no action in it. Just awesome. But the movie is just going to follow greatness with more greatness, because then Charlie goes to the library, the college library, where Alex is reading Dracula, and the entire library confrontation with John Grease vampire werewolf scene is, oh, it's so good. But Alex is speed reading Dracula because she's getting up on knowledge, starting to have a second sixth sense that something is awry here. The John Grease confronts them, and it's hilarious here because Charlie, you know, starts to get really faint and weak because he saw Regine on TV hosting Peter's show. Alex goes off to get him some water to wake his ass up. She gets attacked by or confronted by the vamp wolf, and she slaps him. She's the one who lands the first blow on this werewolf. Charlie comes over to quote unquote protect her. Then he grabs her hand and they run away, ineffectively hiding. The only thing Charlie manages to do in this whole scene is to throw a shelf of books on top of the vampire, slowing him down for like 2 seconds. Charlie has to be the greatest book thrower in the history of horror at this point, after his dorm room move and now this. Louis is so unimpressed with Charlie that the only thing he says to either of them, besides evilly taunting them, is calling Alex a tough chick. And then John Grease is about to tear Charlie's throat out while he's on top of him. And Alex wards him off, by stuffing his mouth full of roses and thorns, which is knowledge she had just gotten from her read of Dracula. So she saves them both. not only taking decisive action, but using knowledge that she just acquired and remembered in the heat of the moment. Now, this is a really weird thing because roses against vampires is not like some famous lore thing. And I looked it up, and wild roses are mainly associated with vampires, it seems, because the thorns of the roses are placed around the graves of suspected vampires to prevent them from returning. And a rose was given to protect someone in the novel Dracula. So this is just an awesome use of the novel and horror knowledge. But another example, and they're going to pile up here really quick as the action increases, in how much more effective Alex is than Charlie, generally speaking. Regine gives her incredible debut hosting performance, which I wish could just be its own short video, like the video in The Ring. Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's not as good as Peter Vincent hosting Fright Night. It's you can't compare the two because she's doing performance art. But this is so cool because on last week's episode, we talked about how much I loved that there was a slasher called Night School that let the villain act like the scared victim for a big stretch of the movie. And when Regine is hosting Fright Night, she performance acts like basically a Little Red Riding Hood character being chased around. And you get to see this powerful vampire act afraid. It would be like watching Michael Myers pantomime someone who running away from him. Right, you get to see her act the other side. She does this incredible move with her hands where she's like basically taking her long nails and trying to attack her own throat. She does a great job of actually looking scared, even though it's all, you know, obviously play acting. She's the scariest vampire around. She pokes her own neck with two of the nails to create like a vampire bite. And the people filming the show, they're just awestruck. They can barely move or say anything. The one guy who's like helping with the fog effects off camera is like, how is she doing that? And the other guy's like, I don't know, special makeup or something. And she's like literally controlling the fog, which I can't believe the people in the studio aren't noticing, manipulating it to cover her at certain moments and then and move aside at certain moments when she needs them to. And then she does this incredibly creepy splashing blood on her face and making her eyes go all vampire-y and letting her fangs show broadcast to the world that she, this is her true, she takes her true form and it's just entertainment. Like it's just on the Fright Night show in between, presumably the movie they're showing. Just remarkable stuff. Peter Vincent shows up to attack her mid-show, gets dragged off on camera, gets arrested, and then immediately gets institutionalized the same way apparently Charlie was at the end of Fright Night 1, according to the lore of this movie. And now that Peter is neutralized, the fearless vampire killer is taken out of the game. It's Charlie on his own. We know he doesn't have a chance by himself. So who's going to fix all this? Well, we got to spring Peter from the institution. Who's going to do that? Yeah, you guessed it. That's right. Alex. She poses as a psychiatrist, which is astounding for a college student to be able to pull off. But she really does it. She's so smart and confident. She also, during this whole sequence, gets attacked by Charlie's psychiatrist, who has now been turned into a vampire. I'm not sure when that happened. I don't even know if he was a vampire the whole time. And that was some kind of sick joke of Regine's, who knows. But don't worry. Like, one-on-one, Alex takes out that vampire. No problem. Watch out, Peter Vincent, fearless vampire killer. Alex is coming for your job at this point. And then the newly freed Peter and Alex team up to go arm up at a nearby church, get some communion wafers, get some holy water. They get Peter Vincent's gear together. There's a great scene where he's telling her where all the props in his apartment are coming from. It's just so obvious that this was made by people who love horror movies. And meanwhile, what is Charlie doing? Well, we find out when they find him, he's lounging around as a prisoner on a sofa wearing like a robe that a vampire Hugh Hefner would wear. He's even being brought a nice tea service by a vampire, because while everyone else is running around doing things, Charlie is just like Frodo-ing it up. The tea-bringing vampire discovers their breakout attempt, and Charlie jumps in and, no, I'm just kidding. Peter sprays him to death with holy water while Charlie watches. Then they go to escape, and Peter climbs out onto this high ledge as they're taking Charlie out the window. And then the window gets slammed closed by Louis, the vampire werewolf. Poor Peter's isolated, hanging by his fingernails, like Die Hard Alan Rickman style, about to plummet to his death. And Charlie jumps in. No, just kidding. Charlie's just watching. But Alex, who's running around the room, locking doors and throwing bars in front of the doors so that the other vampires who are trying to get them can't get in, sees that Charlie's doing fucking nothing, picks up a stake-launching crossbow, tosses it to him, and tells him to do something. So Charlie finally shoots Louis in the heart, and poor Louis dies. An amazing scene, a hilarious death line from him. And they save Peter. I'm only giving Charlie a 0.5 on this kill because it was mostly engineered by Alex. Don't worry, I'm going to do a body count at the end. I think you'd be surprised, or maybe at this point from the tone of my voice, probably not. And then since they can't escape out the window, they head further into the heart of the building, heading towards the vampire lair where we saw Regine originally with the coffin. And this is the final boss confrontation. The entire vampire gang assembles. It's them versus Peter, Alex, and Charlie. Regine makes an incredible Welcome to Fright Night entrance, lights a bunch of candles with her satanic power, tries to force Charlie to kill Alex, and Charlie manages to get out of the situation. Peter's been knocked unconscious at this point. Charlie manages to get out of the situation by hilariously grabbing Belle's claws and ramming them into Bosworth's stomach. Now, Bosworth, I didn't mention this, but there's been this great bit the whole movie where all the vampires are all drinking blood, but Bosworth is just eating bugs. It's a very Renfield thing. And every time he eats a bug, he like names its, I don't even remember what these are called in biology. It's like class, right? It's like Motho Cordata or whatever. So he knows all the names of them. It would be like something from Silence of the Lambs, right? Death's Head Moth or whatever, but the Latin version. And when his gut gets opened, all these bugs that he's been eating have been breeding inside of him. They all spill out. It's absolutely fantastically gross and inventive. His body kind of deflates. It's an unforgettable visual. So I'm giving Charlie a full point for like Freddy Krueger gloving this guy's stomach somehow and getting him, taking him down, but he's not a vampire. So even though I'm giving him a full point, he basically just killed a human. And then Belle attacks them, and Charlie and Alex both throw some kind of holy cloak or robe or something on top of the attacking Belle and take her out. So that's 0.5 kill for both Alex and Charlie there. And then Regine flees to where her coffin is located. We get a confrontation that's this movie's version of the confrontation with Chris Sarandon in Fright Night 1. This one is just as good, which, again, has got to be so hard to pull off. But it's got emotional stakes. It's got great visuals. And then Regine is basically going to vanquish Charlie, naturally. Peter Vincent climbs up the elevator shaft where Regine's coffin has been located, and she kind of like mockingly tells Charlie, I guess your fearless vampire friend has given up. And Peter vanishes off down the hallway into the night, and Regine is about to end it all with Charlie, and all of a sudden you realize that Peter has gone to get a big fragment of mirror. And it's daytime now at this point. It's just the day hasn't penetrated deep into the bowels of this building. And he reflects an incredible shaft of sunlight like a laser to take Regine out from above. It is a great moment. Great visuals. The way the sunlight kills her is fantastic. It's as good as anything Underworld or any other later movies with much bigger budgets did. Peter saves his young friends, being the fearless vampire killer that he knows he is. and does it in a way that like you couldn't even have thought of or predicted. Like when he headed off, I knew he wasn't leaving, but I had no clue what he was doing. And it was so much better than I thought. So then we get his final shot that we talked about in the beginning of this episode, which now has the full emotional charge of knowing all the doubts he had and everything they've gone through. And now he gets this amazing moment, just the best way to see this character off. And then we cut to Alex and Charlie cuddling on a couch. It's not on a couch, cuddling outside in a garden near the college. And Alex, you know, they've won, right? And Alex still has a little trepidation because she's smarter than Charlie, let's admit it. And she asks him, Charlie, what if there are more vampires out there? And in the perfect way to see Charlie's character off, he says, oh, don't worry. If there are other vampires out there, I've got a strategy. And I'm not making this up. This is his strategy. This is what he says. He says, I think we should buy a farm, move in together, me and you, Alex, make babies, and I'll get a mule and a banjo. So she asks him what to do if there are more scary vampires out there in the world. And this is his recommendation. Again, I'm not here to completely bash Charlie, but I've got to say that speaking of hiding in plain sight, this is one of the most infuriating horror hero characters I've ever encountered. And he's so beloved and everyone's like, whatever. And I get it. Like, I love him too. He's a great, Willem Ragsdale's a great actor. Like, it's really cleverly written, but oh my God, he's so pointless. He's so bad at things most of the time. So speaking of bad, let's do the kill count, right? So basically you got to score Peter just a 2 in this movie, but I'm giving him an extra half point because in the 2, he actually killed the head vampire. So I'm giving you an extra 0.5 bump for taking out the most powerful one. Charlie and Alex ended up tied at 3 apiece. So I'm kind of surprised that Charlie even got that high, but Alex clearly is the winner of this movie. She had the least knowledge of vampire existence of anyone. She got read up on vampire knowledge that apparently Charlie himself and Peter even did not possess and used it to ward off Louis. And she kept up with them in the striking back body counts. Alex wins. Plus, after the stupid mule banjo shit that Charlie says, the movie ends on a much funnier last line from Alex. She has the last words in the movie, rightfully so. And then we get this really elegant, slow tracking shot upwards from vampire POV in the sky again. And then the absolutely ravishing notes of the Fright Night Part 2 theme song play us out. The music in this movie is incredible. I covered it like all the things I could think of off the top of my head that I loved. And I didn't even get to all the stuff. This movie has the greatest bowling scenes ever put on film that aren't in the Big Lebowski. There's an insane vampire bowling moment where the vampires are bowling and having a great time. They've killed a human, beheaded him, and they've put him up by the beer taps. They've got a human on tap for blood. I mean, how do you get better than this? There is just so much greatness in this movie. So the story of why... So here, let's put it like this. I posted the anniversary of Fright Night 2 being released on the Horror Weekly Facebook page, which has 500,000 followers. And there was a ton of reaction to the post. It was recent. It's within the last week or so. It's what gave me the thought to do this podcast in the first place, because when I posted it, there were so many comments. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of comments on the posts, but there were so many comments of people saying, what? I didn't know there was a Fright Night 2. I didn't know this movie existed. And let's be real, like, this page is followed by horror fans. Like, I post things and make, like, the slightest factual error, and it's immediately pointed out, which I appreciate, by the way. And it's amazing, like, I'll post things. I had posted something recently about the post-credit scene from the Keanu Reeves movie Constantine. And out of thousands of comments, there were like, I don't know, a dozen or so of people being like, wait, I didn't know there was a post-credit scene. But with Fright Night Part 2, there were hundreds and hundreds of horror fans who were like, I had no idea this was a thing. So there's a reason or a set of reasons that a lot of horror fans don't know this was a thing. And here's quickly the strange tale of what happened to Fright Night Part 2 after it was while it was being made and after it released. So the first Fright Night was definitely a hit, right? It made a ton of money for the time. And so the timing for a sequel couldn't have been better. On top of that, the horror comedy trail had already been blazed by Ghostbusters just the year before. And Fright Night and Ghostbusters were both released by Columbia Pictures, so it's not like they could miss the message. So the producers were ready to start filming a sequel before the original was even released. I mean, they knew they had something going on. Everyone involved believed in continuing the story as soon as they could. So why was there a four-year delay? Well, there was a big changing of leadership at Columbia Pictures. And the new people just didn't have enthusiasm for horror films. They were spending their time trying to figure out how to win Oscars by making fucking movies like Chariots of Fire. So that bad timing shut down the immediate sequel idea for Fright Night 2. The rights to the future of Fright Night ended up with a small company called New Century Vista or New Century Vista Film Company or something like that. They released The Gate and I think The Wraith. So when the script for Fright Night 2 was developed, Evil Ed and Amy were both coming back. But by the time they got Tommy Lee Wallace on board, the script went in a new direction that didn't include Ed and Amy. Stephen Joffrey's went out to go do Robert Englund's directorial debut, 976 Evil. Amanda Bierce was already starting her amazing run on Married with Children. Tom Holland and Chris Sarandon were committed to something else called Child's Play. So Tommy Lee Wallace had to make the best of it. He still tried to get Tom Holland's input to make it a proper sequel, at least as much as he could. He and the new Century Vista people added the Regine storyline arc and added all the characters that I came to love, like Belle and Bosworth and Louis. And also the budget was cut down by like $1.5 million off the original idea. So by the time the movie was released on May 19th, 1989, it only opened on 148 screens, and basically nobody cared, which sucked. But it gets worse, because the head of New Century Vista happened to be a man named Jose Menendez. Tom Holland and Roddy McDowall were in talks with him on the prospects of coming back to do a Fright Night Part 3, when on August 20th, 1989, Menendez and his wife were fatally shot by their two sons, Lyle and Eric Menendez, the Menendez brothers. So Fright Night 2 got caught up in a very chaotic reshuffling that happened at New Century Vista, and it's been in rights hell basically ever since. It came out really quietly on VHS, and then came out again on a very expensive and quickly out of print DVD. So Fright Night Part 2 was doomed from the start, much like Charlie's soon-to-be banjo-playing career. And it's a real shame that that happened. But silver lining, as a lifelong horror fan, having watched thousands of horror movies and TV shows and episodes and read a million horror novels, you run out of things, right? There's no way something can come back and surprise you. But there are so many horror fans out there like me who have become a little bit jaded and seen too much horror who don't know that Fright Night Part 2 exists. And then there's another set of horror fans out there who saw it and maybe just didn't give it the love that it deserved. And if they go back and rewatch it, they'll see. And then there's a new generation who get a chance to see what a great horror sequel. Because let's be honest, making a really good horror sequel is not easy. So there is just a huge audience out there waiting for Fright Night Part 2 to land on them and shine. It's not perfect. I kind of hate the psychiatrist killing scene, for example, but it is amazing. It's worthy. It didn't trash the movie it came from, which is very hard to do when you're dealing with a true classic. It has amazing characters, incredible music. It's really, really well directed and thought out. And it contains legendary moments. I could not love this movie more if I tried. And I'd love to hear your feedback if you've had any experience of Fright Night Part 2, either as someone who saw it at the time or saw it long ago, or someone who's coming new to it for the first time. I really want to talk about this movie. I know I just did, but talk with someone. So hit us up at the Horror Weekly Facebook page or on Horror Weekly Instagram. If you have thoughts on Fright Night Part 2, either or, if you hated it, like, I'm not going to be offended. We're very open-minded here. So hopefully you enjoyed this episode. And we're done. I can't follow Fright Night Part 2 with anything up. It would be desecration. So until next Wednesday, have a great horror week.